So thank you for the kind introduction. Thank you everyone for being here. The focus of the research I'll be presenting on today is adenocarcinomas of the esophagus and gastrocardia, although I will also be presenting data for squamous cell carcinoma as well as other gastric cancers for comparison purposes. I have no relationships. I have nothing to disclose. As you can see from the first slide, there's been a dramatic increase in the incidence of adenocarcinomas of the esophagus, beginning around 1980 and continuing forward. At the same time, there's been a leveling off or a slight decrease of esophageal squamous cell carcinomas. And one of the other interesting features of this cancer, of these two cancers to point out, is that while adenocarcinomas of the esophagus are much more common among white males, you see the inverse for squamous cell carcinoma, where it's predominantly a cancer of black men. And this slide's a little bit older, but you can see a similar trend happening for gastrocardia, the bottom two lines, which are increasing, versus other stomach cancers, which have been, again, you see the difference between black and white males, and you see the difference in incidence of gastrocardia adenocarcinomas increasing, while other stomach cancers have been either leveling off or decreasing slightly. And just to orient you, a substantial fraction of adenocarcinomas occur near the junction of the esophagus and gastrocardia, and they tend to be classified as adenocarcinomas of the gastrocardia. And so it's hard to distinguish between adenocarcinomas of the esophagus versus the gastrocardia, because they occur in such close proximity. And given this close proximity, questions started to arise as to whether or not they were also etiologically similar. And as a result, beginning in the early 1980s, when little was known about risk factors for these cancers, there's been a growth in research in this area, looking for not only etiologic risk factors, but reasons to explain the time trends. And as a result, a number of non-dietary risk factors were identified. Gastroesophageal reflux disease was one of the big ones, which increases your risk, particularly for those adenocarcinomas, along with body mass index and cigarette smoking, which is already a known risk factor for squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus. In addition, the most recent American Institute of Cancer Research expert panel report identified some dietary risk factors, and by and large, there was enough evidence to support a probable inverse association with fruit and vegetables, a probable increased risk associated with meat consumption. Grains are mixed. It's hard to say because not everybody distinguishes between refined and whole grains in their research methodology. Those that do seem to indicate an increased risk associated with those refined starchy grains, whereas whole grains may decrease your risk, and there's only been a handful, maybe two or three at this point, of studies that have looked at dairy products particularly. And one of the challenges in the literature is that most of it hasn't distinguished between esophageal squamous cell and adenocarcinomas, or they've been driven largely by those other cancers that we already knew quite a bit about. And so there was a need to really explore these new time trends. And so what I did is took data from a multi-center case control study, and this was conducted in Connecticut, New Jersey, and Washington State, all of which have surveillance systems in place with rapid reporting, to look at dietary and other lifestyle factors, to look at the risk that associates with adenocarcinomas of the esophagus and gastrocardia, and then using those other two cancer subtypes as a comparison. And we wanted to apply, I've looked at this data using the more traditional approaches, logistic regression, and I was frustrated because you get a lot of multicollinearity. Nobody eats just dark green leafy vegetables. Nobody eats just red meats. And so trying to tease that apart. And so we looked at it in a few different ways. I initially used principal components analysis to try to look at how things hung together. But I was really trying to get a larger picture of the whole diet and how do you balance risk when there are these multi-level risk factors. And so this, what I'll be presenting today, is my classification tree analysis. And so again, I took this large population of English-speaking men and women who were diagnosed between 1993 and 1995 from these states that had the rapid reporting systems in place so we could identify the cases and then conduct standard structured in-person interviews with either the respondent or the proxy. And I think I have in a later slide, the reason we needed proxies is because these are rapidly progressing cancers. We had a mean follow-up time from when the cases were identified to interview for cases. It was 3.7 months. But even then, in many cases, that's not quick enough for esophageal and gastric cancers. We looked at a number of exposures, diet, tobacco, alcohol. There were questions about medication use, symptoms, obesity, occupations, et cetera. I'm not sure how many people here are familiar with classification tree analysis, but it's a fairly complex. There's a whole really lovely book by Breeman if you want to learn about it in depth, but the quick overview is that study subjects are initially classified into what's called the parent node, and I'll show you a tree in just a moment, where you can see the number of cases and the number of controls. And this is a data-driven method, and so the software will then select the variable that you input that has the most risk stratification, that separates out the most cases from the most controls. From there, you grow these trees, and I just came from this great talk on social epidemiology where they had actual pretty trees. Mine don't look like that. And they start growing the trees, and eventually what you get is a tree that completely fits your data, which is completely not useless in the real world, and so you then prune that back, and the trees get compared to one another until you have a tree that has the best fit without overfitting, so that you can start to make predictions and apply this to other databases or data sets. So overall, we had 687 controls. For esophageal adenocarcinoma, there are 282 cases, 255 of gastrocardia, 206 of esophageal squamous cell carcinoma, and 352 of those other gastric cancers. Predominantly male cases, and what's really sort of interesting to highlight is that among the percent of non-white, not surprisingly for esophageal squamous cell carcinoma, they're much higher, so 21%, and those would be African American, primarily males. So before I show you the tree, for each tree what you'll see is information on splitting nodes as well as terminal nodes. It's important to note that as I just showed here, it's not a 50-50 split between cases and controls. We had a lot more controls than cases, and so for each of those, a high-risk group would be anybody that has a higher percentage than what we would see in the population. So I'll show you. So this is for adenocarcinoma. Again, there were 687 controls and 282 cases, so that's about 29% of cases. So any terminal node that had more than 29%. Again, there were 687 controls and 282 cases, so that's about 29% of cases. 0.5 symptoms per year. So that means you've had reflux this year. So any bit of reflux seems to increase your risk. For the low-risk group, people who don't have any reflux, that's actually where the tree ended. For those who did have reflux symptoms, the next split was on red meat. And what I found really interesting was that that's a fairly low amount, that's servings per day, so that's 0.68. So about two-thirds of a serving a day of red meat seems to be associated with an increased risk. And I'll just grow this out for you. Oops, sorry. So you can see what that looks like. What I think is very interesting, and this is in keeping with our previous findings about the increased association with red meat as well as with raw vegetables and non-citrus fruits, is that if you're eating a lot of red meat and you're also not eating a lot of your non-citrus fruits, you're in a high-risk category. If you're not eating a lot of red meat, but you're also not eating a lot of green vegetables, and that's 0.04 servings a day, so almost no dark green vegetables, you're also going to be at a high-risk category. And so what this seems to be telling us is it's a matter of how do you balance? The take-home message for me is how do you explain to people how to balance their own risk factors? So if you have somebody who likes to eat red meat, that's fine, it's not great, but please make sure that you're also eating your fruits and vegetables. So don't just be the meat and starchy potatoes person. For gastrocardia adenocarcinomas, we had 27% of cases in this group. And again, reflux, not surprisingly based on the previous research that's been done, was the most important in terms of risk stratification. The other really interesting thing here is that reflux came into this tree at 4 times. And so this seems to imply somewhat of a dose-response relationship, right? So if you have any reflux, higher risk. The next category is more than once a day that you're experiencing these reflux symptoms, which was one of the higher risk categories. And similar to what we found in our food groups analysis using logistic regression, there wasn't a lot of dietary risk factors that came into play here, except way down at the end, which was refined grains. Now, I would interpret that with some caution because you can see there's only 12 people in that last note down there, so things start to get a little funny, but there does seem to be some indication of risk there as well. Next tree is for esophageal squamous cell carcinoma, and if you recall, this group was very different. So they were more likely to be African American, low income, more likely to be smokers, drink alcohol, and have relatively low energy intake in terms of kilo. They were more likely to be African American, low income, more likely to be smokers, drink alcohol, non-white, and low energy. So nothing terribly surprising there, except that, again, citrus fruit. So of the diet, fruit seems to be important. And it seems to, you know, modify that risk associated with reflux symptoms. And last but not least, we had our other gastric cancer. This was about 23% of the sample. And this was actually very surprising to see reflux come in. It's not been identified as one of the most common risk factors. People tend to think of nitrites, salted foods, smoking, alcohol. What I will say is that body mass index has been associated with an increased risk of this type of cancer, and in our principal components analysis, reflux and BMI hung together very tightly. So it may just be this got picked first because it edged it out slightly. Age came into this tree as well. The first time we see they're very tightly. So it may just be this got picked first because it edged it out slightly. And again, we see the importance of these dark green vegetables and avoiding refined grains and looking at balancing refined grains and whole grains. And so this was actually, interestingly enough, the most complex tree that pulled from both medical, dietary, and lifestyle factors. The other ones seem to really focus on one side or the other. And so the overall conclusions here are that different combinations of risk factors seem to interact to determine risk of each of these subtypes of cancers, and that these methods may be useful in partitioning the risk and looking, mapping these multi-level interactions. It also goes to the question of, are these cancers etiologically similar? And while there are some similarities, you look, reflux came into every single model. They came into the models at different places for different cancers. And while cigarettes came in as more important for some than others, and red meat for some and not others, and nitrates and some and not others, there are some differences. So they're similar, but they're not exact. They don't overlap. And there may be some beginning evidence about balancing positive and negative, if you want to use those terms, behaviors for attenuating risk. It's very easy to tell people to eat healthy, but it would be nice to be able to say, okay, well, if you're not willing to give up red meat, what can you do to balance your risk? Because that's the reality we live in. And it may be helpful to look at multiple methodologies to better inform prevention strategies. I'm going to skip that one because I'm running low on time. I just want to acknowledge, again, this is a multi-center study, so lots of people from lots of different places. In particular, I worked with the Yale site, so Harvey Reich is in Maine and Rob Dubrow. Questions? So the controls were selected using random digit dialing and healthcare financing administration rosters. Sorry, I skipped through that a little quick in the interest of time. Yes?
Why did you
eliminate non-able people? At the time, it was really a matter of working with the populations in place as well as who was available to do the interviews, that we just didn't have the resources to look at other populations. Though I know that the Yale site is now gone on to look at Latinos in Connecticut as well.
I have one more question.
Yes.
Did you match your controls?
Yes, so controls were matched based on five-year age group, gender, race, and study site. So Connecticut within Connecticut, New Jersey.
But was it specific to specific cancers or?
No, they weren't matched by cancer. Thank you very much.